You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, September 8th, 2022. My name is Matt Binder, and this is the five-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live today, both steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in Brooklyn and steps from Citi Field, home of the Mets, New York's number one baseball team.
Let's go, Mets, baby.
Yes, in the real heartland of America, Queens, New York City. And why are we broadcasting from both today? Well, because I, Matt Binder, am filling in for Emma, who usually hosts the Thursday show, and then myself and Brandon of the Discourse joins us for the joins her for the second half. But Emma's also here, not only in spirit, but actually here with a pre-tape, because she will be conducting a wonderful pre-taped interview in what turns out just might end up being Queen Elizabeth II's last interview. No, that would be something, wouldn't it? But she actually has a great interview with Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, discussing his new book, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Also on the show today, well, I mentioned it, God Save the Queen. The royal family flies into Her Majesty's residence in Scotland in order to be by her side as doctors announce they are deeply concerned for Queen Elizabeth II's health. We here at the Majority Report will be providing minute-to-minute coverage, dedicating the entire show to this, obviously, right after Emma's interview with Will Bunch.
Your royal experts, the Majority
right.
Report.
Exactly. We'll also be discussing what this means for Meghan Markle and all that fun stuff that we all care so much about here on the Majority Report. Also, Chuck Schumer announces a marriage equality vote in the Senate in our post-Roe Times to codify it. Trump apparently explains his trove of classified materials to his White House team as needing to preserve Russiagate documents from being destroyed by his enemies. A public official has been arrested in Las Vegas as part of an investigation into the killing of a veteran Vegas journalist. This story is wild. This journalist had apparently been covering this public official in a number of bombshell reports, and now this public official has been arrested in connection with his death. We also have a story here about the second assailant in that stabbing spree in Canada has died while under police custody. He was arrested and just hours later turns up dead, announced dead by the police. Much more will come out about that, hopefully. And New York Governor Kathy Hochul has lifted the mask mandate entirely on New York City subways. Before she did that, masks were still required while riding the subway system in New York City. That is no longer the case. It is now being suggested, but not mandated. Folks, all that and much, much, much more to talk about on this episode of the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to be here with you all again, hosting the free half of the show, mere weeks after I filled in for Sam and Emma. Clearly, I did such a great job, and the people demanded I come back to fill in again when necessary, and your wish is my command. Here I am, Matt Leck. Bradley, thank you so much for joining me. Always a pleasure to be here with you guys. How y'all doing today?
We are doing really well, Binder. It's good to have you back. You're becoming a familiar, you hosting is becoming a, once again, familiar sight.
Yeah, I love to be here. As you were saying last time when I was out, Binder, as in the MR fun, it's all the boys today.
Yeah, it's the boys, right? And then when Brandon joins us, man.
It's going to be all the boys. Let's go, Brandon. But yeah, I was up till 3 a.m. watching tennis last night, so I'm very chipper. Mm. I'm very wired, so happy to get into the news now.
Speaking of the news, before we get to Emma's interview with Will Bunch, let's actually get into something that I previewed just moments before. And that is, you know, Senator Chuck Schumer announced that there will be a vote on marriage equality in the Senate in the next few weeks. You know, this comes after the Supreme Court dismantled Roe v. Wade and a number of states now practically making abortion entirely illegal in those states. There was a real push to codify a number of other human rights that could possibly be curtailed by this right-wing Supreme Court. And first up on the docket seems to be this vote for marriage equality, same-sex marriage. And, you know, the Democrats clearly believe they have the votes there, at least 10 Republicans who will join them to vote in favor of marriage equality remaining the law of the land in this country. But one such Republican senator seems to be, I don't know if even waffling, excuse me, is the right term here. More like maybe an about face, so a 180 here on his previously announced position. And that is obviously a favorite around here. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. You know, maybe he's realizing he's got a real chance to lose this November in his race against his general election race against the Democratic candidate. And he goes, he has a great Twitter username, by the way, too. The Other Mandela. That's a great Twitter username. Everyone check Ron Johnson's opponent out. But let's get to this clip here of Ron Johnson on this marriage equality vote. Where was he? This was on a radio show, right?
This was like a county meeting for some sort of
the Common Sense Citizens of Washington.
Yeah, so like some interest group that he was having like some sort of Q&A with. So a person asks him like, "Are you really going to basically?" He's basically saying, "Are you really going to vote for a same-sex marriage codification bill?"
Right, right. So that's why there's just audio here. Someone recorded this while at this event. Okay, let's get to that clip right now.
How you're going to vote on that and why?
Sure. So again, you have to understand the process here. You're walking down the subway in the Capitol, and all of a sudden you get descended by National Press Code. You know, again, what are you? You're going to support HR 84? What are you talking? I've never even heard of this. Okay. So you just get hounded on this crap, right? So just to get him off my backs, I wrote a press release, and I said I always supported civil unions. Never felt that we need to do anything other than that. But then the Supreme Court ruled, and I just considered the matter settled. Okay, I do not in any way, shape, or form believe that Obergefell will ever be overturned because of stare decisis. Now, completely different than Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade need to be overturned to protect people in the future. Stare decisis is really powerful when if the Supreme Court were to overrule a previous decision, even if it's wrongly decided. And that's kind of how this all came up because, you know, Justice Thomas is probably right that it was wrongly decided, but that's a different issue as to whether or not the Supreme Court will overturn it. They never will. I don't see any scenario. So with all those caveats, I said at this point, I don't see a reason to oppose it, to get them off my back, okay? Now, immediately, I started hearing from people, and I've got all kinds of reasons to be concerned about it, and primarily on the basis of religious liberty. So I'm working with Mike Lee, the best attorneys, best senators who are attorneys in the Senate, and we're going to have just a smoking amendment that is going to protect religious liberty, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Yeah.
But no, I would not support it in its current state. Okay. But at the same time, I don't want to see millions of lives disrupted either. I mean, to me, that was a wound that was healed. Let it go. Okay. Move on. Okay, we've got enough problems. We have enough things to divide this nation. Let's not drag that back up. So I'm not happy with the Baldwins of the world who are just opening that wound and opening up that debate. Okay, we need to solve the whole abortion issue, and that's going to take probably years to come up with what societal consensus is there. Okay.
I mean, I gotta say, I thought he was gonna go with the excuse that they just threw something at him. The press was following him while he was walking through Congress halls, and they threw something at him. And without knowing what it was, he just responded, and then he got back to his office and realized, oh, this is the bill they were talking about. I was wrong. But no. He goes a step further and goes, yeah. I heard their questions, went back to my office, sat down with my team. We wrote a whole response in support of it. And we just did all of that to shut the media up. I don't really support this now that I'm getting some blowback from my right-wing constituents and other members of my party, I'm sure. Really, not stunning stuff, although I know we like using that word stunning here on this show, because that's exactly who someone like Ron Johnson is. But it really helps pull back the curtain on a lot of these Republicans and how they will say whatever they think they need to say in that moment in time to just not take any flack for what their true views are. You're seeing this with a lot of Republicans right now who previously were full on, very vocally anti-abortion as we got closer and closer to that Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade. And that's probably where they're the vast majority of those guys, their true views lie. But then once it happened and they saw the pushback from the vast majority of the American people who were not happy with that decision and are pro-choice, now all of a sudden they're at least in front of cameras hedging and changing their views and saying, no, I'm not going to do anything to your abortion rights. I mean, the idea that any of this stuff is protected and a done deal after what we saw is Roe. Any one of these guys who say that to you is lying to your face. I mean, we've seen that it doesn't matter how long something has been the standard, how long something's been law of the land. It can be literally decades. We can be told it's protected. The Supreme Court has already decided on this. We can be told this by the Supreme Court justices themselves, who then will also go ahead just a few years later and then throw what they said in the garbage and vote to dismantle Roe. They are lying to you when they say any of these things can be changed. And they're lying to you when they try to change their position once they realize where the American people stand on this and are worried about their election and their race in November.
It's kind of a wild tack he takes too, where he's like, I was doing it to get the media off my back. However, I know that Clarence Thomas did indicate that Obergefell was wrongly decided, but I don't think that's going to be a precedent that will be overturned in the future. So I don't think it's even worth focusing on. And don't get me wrong, covering his tracks at the end of the clip, I don't want any of these civil unions and these gay married people to have their lives disrupted. It's a combo essentially of being like, I'm with you, I don't support it. I understand that it might be overturned, which I'm also probably fine with, but also I feel super bad if it really screws over a ton of people that I said I wasn't going to try and screw over. Like, he's really trying to have it every single way and I think that, like you said, this clip in particular is a huge testament to the slipperiness of these types of elected officials. They want to be able to tout their bona fides on these things without having to actually ever reconcile with the consequences or ramifications of those positions.
Oh, exactly. And another thing to note too, and you just brought it up there, that last point he makes about not wanting to, intrude on people's lives and break families apart. I mean, literally that's what happened with the destruction of Roe v. Wade. And we're seeing these states outright outlaw abortion. You are completely destroying people's lives in multiple ways when they can't go out and make decisions about their own bodies. I mean, talk about dismantling lives. Ask a woman who has to, who is worried about their fetus. Once they find out that they have to carry a fetus that has no chance at living, but they live in a state where they can't get the abortion services. You don't think that dismantles their lives? Someone who wanted a baby and found out that something went horribly wrong, but they still have to carry the fetus that will not be born alive to term? I mean, this is ridiculous. And then the case of a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, any sort of child that's raped or is sexually abused and gets pregnant, you don't think forcing them to carry a baby to term is going to dismantle and destroy their lives? But no, we should trust them that they wouldn't do anything to intrude on people's lives. Give me a break. Do not trust these people at all. If you worry about your rights, the rights of your family members, the rights of your friends, or you're just a good person and worry about people's rights, even if you don't know them personally, you should go and vote against these people in November. Ron Johnson has a great Democratic opponent in Mandela Barnes. Check him out. Vote for him if you're in Wisconsin in November. And with all that said, let's go to the interview. Emma Vigeland, who is the host of the brand new Emma Sports Vigeland Network, ESVN, has a great interview for you all with Will Bunch, a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, about his new book, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. And here that interview is. See you all in just a little bit. Enjoy the interview.
We are back, and we are joined now by Will Bunch, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News and author of After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics, and How to Fix It. Will, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Emma. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Well, it's a good time to have you on, given the student debt news that came a few weeks back. Let's talk about that. What was your response, given your scholarly works on this front, to Biden canceling $10,000 of student debt, $20,000 if you were a Pell Grant recipient and up to a $125,000 income threshold?
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing to see this all come to a head right when my book was coming out. Most authors don't get that lucky in timing it, but it really is coming to a head in the sense that this is kind of the culmination of a bad decision that we made 40 years ago to basically privatize higher education in America. And when I say privatize, I mean putting the burden for getting an education on individuals and their families. It wasn't always that way. You know, there was, as I describe in my book, I mean, there was basically a golden age of college and higher education in America in which, college tuition was very low. It was even free at some places like the University of California. I'm talking about the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And then we made a series of bad decisions, some of them political, some of them the backlash to the infamous campus protest movements of the 1960s, for one thing. And, tuition started to rise in the late 70s, early 80s, for a combination of factors. But part of it was just governments, especially conservative governments, yanking their taxpayer support for these public universities and forcing them to go to tuition to keep the ball rolling on campus. And for most middle class families, the only way to get this diploma, which is really has become the piece of paper that you need to stay in the middle class, was to borrow money. And so I think Biden's decision to cancel some of this debt, I mean, I would like to see it go farther. I'm hoping this is only a first step, but I do think it's important because it's starting to turn that battleship around where we're starting to acknowledge that society does have, American society does have some responsibility for providing an education to our young people, beyond the age of 18, which I think we do. And, you know, it's not a full acknowledgement, but it's really the first big step away from this privatization of college that we endured for all those decades since the Reagan years.
And I want to go through that history because I think it's so fascinating and you lay it out so well. But, you know, something you just mentioned is how the only way for middle class families or poorer families to be included in the system was to either go into debt themselves or have their children go into debt via student loans. There is, I think, something to that we've talked about in this program that I think I like emphasizing, and I'm curious about your take on it, is the way that debt became a almost disciplinary tool of a class of capitalists, really, to essentially funnel certain people into jobs and systems that they might not ordinarily choose. In your study on this, what did you find on that front?
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one thing that I didn't know until a couple of years ago, really until I started researching this book, was to the extent that conservative thought leaders in the late 60s, the early 1970s, really actively talked about the idea that higher tuition was basically a means of social control. That, you know, that they expressed the thought that not having tuition at places like Berkeley was what encouraged unrest, encouraged people to revolt. They wanted a system that, as you said, I mean, was very capitalist in nature, which making college, you know, an investment, just the way that corporations, you know, leverage themselves to buy another company or whatever. You're basically leveraging yourself to get this education, this investment in yourself, that you have to borrow money and then you have to produce the income to pay back the money that you borrow. Just like, you know, companies have to make the profits to pay back the money they borrow for these mergers and acquisitions or whatever. I mean, it's really a very similar mindset. I mean, during the heyday of college in the 1960s, you know, so many kids of the working class, kids of farmers and factory workers, you know, were getting these inexpensive college educations. And there was an element of the establishment that when they saw people protesting the Vietnam War, for example, was terrified by what was happening. There's a famous quote from an advisor to both Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan, a guy whose name Roger Freeman, who told the San Francisco Chronicle in 1970, an educated proletariat, we can't have that. That would be dynamite. You know, talk about saying the quiet part out loud, right? I mean, they were terrified of a smart working class, capable of critical thinking, able to look at some of the hypocrisy that existed in American society around things like Vietnam and around, white supremacy and those sorts of things. And, I think, you know, the average parent who is so focused on this struggle now to, you know, save money for college and also to make sure that their kid, you know, gets SAT prep or whatever to get into the right schools, they don't even realize what the origins of this whole system are. But it's really appalling when you understand kind of the political and sociological underpinnings of this. It's really quite remarkable.
And you still see this, the muscle memory of this kind of thinking today, even though it's much less applicable, when right wingers are constantly besmirching college campuses as liberal havens for blue haired hippies and baristas who just want to smoke pot all day. Right. Like they feel threatened by college campuses, but not really college campuses today, which we can get into how that's changed a little bit, but more almost the phantom of what college campuses were in terms of like the protest it engendered and the communal spaces that it created for young people to honestly become more leftist and radicalized because of being around others like that in terms of anti-war protests and civil rights movement, et cetera.
Yeah, you know, you made several great points in that question because, a couple of things. I mean, one, I think, although you don't have protest movements like you did in the 60s and early 70s, but you know, it is true that the experience of going to college, you become part of a community, and a good, healthy college experience, I think, helps people develop tolerance and understanding, because you're working with people from other cultures, you're meeting people from different backgrounds and different parts of the world, and that, you know, there's a conservative element in this country that is still terrified by that. But you're right. It is also kind of a mythological view of what college is really like, because if you go to a public university nowadays, you know, I'm not talking about Harvard, but I'm talking about places I visited for the book, like, you know, Kutztown University in central Pennsylvania. For so many middle-class kids, it's just a struggle to stay afloat. You know, food insecurity is rampant on today's college campuses. In areas like California that are so unaffordable from a housing point of view, homelessness is out of control, where you have, you know, hundreds of students who are going to school while living in their cars. Kids, not that many, this whole thing that Ted Cruz and whatever keeps talking about, the cliche of the gender studies major who becomes a barista or whatever, the most popular majors for the last few decades have been business and, to a lesser degree, STEM, because, you know, people are focused on jobs. I mean, it's a big change, you know, that, in the late 60s, a nationwide survey of college freshmen said the main reason people felt they were going to college was to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. That started to change in the 80s, and the number one answer became, you know, to get on a career track, to make money. And, that mindset still influences students today. So they're not majoring in puppeteering and gender studies and, you know, whatever. But there's a lot of mythology. You're right.
Well, it has to be, right? And you have to search for or pursue a degree that is going to pay off your investment, which for so many people is tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And then you have, like, culturally conservatives and other people saying we should just have trade schools and kids should be working so they understand how to be a great cog in the machine of the economy, as opposed to the more holistic view of education, which is to just become a more enlightened person, as you say. Like, that has changed because of the financialization of college. And, we can touch on that for sure, but I wanted to get to the history of what you describe here, because that was so fascinating to me. How in the 40s, the federal government began to talk about college as potentially a public good, and there were some ways we could have gone and some ways we went. Take us through that time period in the 40s and when this began to be a national discussion in the middle of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, up through the mid 20th century, you know, college by and large tended to be for very elite people, the stereotype of the WASPy, established wealthy family. 5% of American adults had college degrees in the early 1940s. The GI Bill was this kind of fluke that the government was trying to figure out how they were going to deal with several million returning veterans at the end of World War II. And one of the ideas that got kicked around was giving them a college benefit. And it was assumed at the time that most people in the middle class just weren't college material. You know, people, the majority of Americans actually didn't even graduate high school in that era. So they didn't think a lot of people were going to take advantage of this, and they were wrong. There was a flood of people, who wanted a better life, who wanted to work with their minds instead of with their hands. And, these elite colleges that poo-pooed the GI Bill initially came back a year or two later and said that these GIs were the best students they'd ever had, because they wanted to learn and, you know, they were respectful and they really were so grateful for the opportunity to get ahead in society. And it really kicked off, like I said, what I call the golden age of college in America, because it, you know, coincidentally, it flowed right into the baby boom, right? So you had, you know, right after the GI Bill, you had this generation coming up. You had, you know, the middle class prosperity to some degree, at least mainly for white people, but you did have prosperity in the 50s and people looking at, you know, people still had the American dream of doing better than their parents' generation. And in that era, college became the way to do that. College became the American dream. And, you know, state governments had pretty full tax coffers back in that era, and they used and spending those tax dollars on expanding their universities, hiring professors, building new dorms was a popular way for them to spend their tax dollars back in that time. College was popular, and they were able to keep tuition low. Like I said, you know, you could go to a state university for a couple hundred dollars a semester. You could probably work a summer job and make enough money to pay your tuition and have something left to buy books and whatever. And like I said, people, you know, people really embraced the idea of a liberal education, that college was for critical thinking. And so you saw, you know, majors like philosophy or sociology or English literature were much more popular then, because, you know, people, again, this idea that college was a place to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. And the job market was good. So people weren't terrified that they weren't going to be able to get a job if they majored in philosophy. So, you know, you had all that. And then, as we discussed a couple minutes ago, when liberal education caused people to ask questions about what was happening here at home, about what was happening in the South with segregation initially, and then later in the 60s, you know, the Vietnam War and other social problems. And there was inevitably a conservative backlash. And, you know, we all know who the avatar of that backlash was. It was Ronald Reagan, who in 1966 was an underdog candidate for governor of California. You know, he seized on this kind of older working class, you know, resentment of these college kids who were protesting, you know, who'd gotten this opportunity and were, to their mind, were using this opportunity to protest the system. And there was a conservative backlash against that. You know, Reagan rode that to a landslide victory. You know, he said he didn't think taxpayers should be subsidizing the intellectual curiosity of young people. And that, I mean, to me, he said that in 1967. And to me, that's the turning point. That's when the new philosophy of privatizing education started, higher education started to take root. And, you know, the economics of the 70s started to bring in higher tuition, and we were off to the races.
And in that period before Reagan kind of ushers in this era that you describe, you mentioned how accessible college was, but it also, and yes, predominantly for white people, but
yeah,
HBCUs started to rise in prominence. And also there were black, and by prominence, I mean in terms of just in more enrolling more kids.
That's correct. Yes.
But black students also did start to go to white institutions as well, which I think helped foster some of the activism that we saw, which leads to Reagan being, you know, wagging his finger at it and eventually, of course, becoming president and doing all he can to.
Yeah, I mean, there was a racial component to the backlash, you know, and in the book, I mean, I start the chapter, which I think was kind of my favorite chapter to write, and I think is to write, and was also, I think is maybe the most important chapter in the book, of explaining the history of the 60s and how everything turned then. But I start that chapter with the Greensboro lunch counter sit-ins of 1960, because not only was that organized and led by black people, black students, but it electrified both black and white students across the country. And it really tapped into this kind of sense of dissatisfaction that was settling in, and it kind of gave a name to it and gave it, you know, gave it some energy. And so no, you're absolutely right. I think the power, you know, the power of, you know, the increasing black power of that era, which was reflected in some degree by increasing black enrollment and black education, was absolutely a part of what was going on, a big part.
And at the same time, we see the Vietnam War, and these campuses become social havens or community spaces, really, for young people, where maybe you can talk to your friend and say, hey, what's going on over there? Why is my friend getting drafted? And as the people's experiences become to be shared about how unjust the Vietnam War is, this leads to not just civil rights protests coming out of colleges, but anti-war protests. So these just like broad left-wing principles are embedded in these students in the middle of the 60s and going into the late 60s.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that's maybe a little bit misunderstood or forgotten about that era is, I think for the establishment, there was a real concern, particularly about what was happening at kind of the large public universities, because these were the places where the middle class was going to, again, getting back to that Roger Freeman remark about the educated proletariat. I mean, you know, I think it wasn't an accident that where you finally had violence against students, it was at Kent State in Ohio, which is
1970,
a school,
right? So it just marks the end of this era.
But Kent State was a school that was heavily populated by the kids of the tire factories of Akron and of Cleveland, which was a heavily industrial area there. And then also at an HBCU, right? Jackson State, you had two students who were killed there by police or law enforcement 2 weeks after Kent State. And it just kind of shows, I mean, you know, there's a lot of focus in history about the protests at places like Columbia or at Harvard, and not that they weren't significant on some level, but I think it was really the idea that schools like Kent State or HBCUs like Jackson State might become the vanguard of some kind of revolution. I think that's what really terrified, you know, the Nixon administration and the establishment. And you know, you started to see this cutback. You know, a year after Kent State, you saw the infamous Powell memo by Lewis Powell, the future Supreme Court justice, in which he looked at how conservatives could fight back against this threat to the system. And, you know, he identified the threat as heavily centered on college campuses. That's where business and capitalism saw the threat to their hegemony coming from. And you know, it played out in many ways, you know, in terms of trying to put more conservative centers and faculty on campus to some degree, but mainly it played out in these tuition wars and just decreased support from state governments and also from the federal government. So, you know, when Reagan became president in 1980, he followed through on his philosophy from California. You know, Pell Grants, you know, which didn't have to be paid back, became less and less of a factor in paying for education, and loans became the primary way that people could finance their education.
And loans, in terms of the from the creditor's perspective, were essentially unshackled. That's not a fair characterization, but I mean, I don't know what you would call it, but in terms of the limits for the credit from the creditors' side, those were that rewritten to benefit them during this time period. Is that correct?
Yeah. The private lenders who were involved in the system in the first iteration had some liability, and they didn't want to write these loans they really forced the government to step in and take 100% responsibility for these loans. And the problem with that system, as we all know, is it was no break whatsoever on tuition increases. And also, you know, Congress, under pressure from its constituents to keep this American dream of college still going, you know, kept reducing kind of limits on what these loans could do. I mean, if you look at something like the Parent Plus program that they came up with in the 80s and 90s to give parents an additional way to finance their kids' education, you know, they eliminated credit checks, and they basically eliminated any limits on how much families could borrow to pay for college. And, you know, many families, you know, their kid wanted to go to the school of his dreams. Maybe it was NYU or some expensive place. And next thing you know, these parents are selling their house, or, you know, they owe $200,000, or, you know, I've read about parents who owe with a couple kids who owe like $500,000. I think Bruce Springsteen calls this debts no honest man can pay, right? I mean, it's just become an insane system over the last 35 years. And, you know, it's amazing that just now in 2022, we're finally taking the first steps to maybe hopefully reckon with this.
And what fuels this incredible rise in tuition during this time period, this explosion of tuition prices?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those situations where people want a simple answer, but it's not simple. You know, as you might expect, it was really a variety of factors. But I mean, to me, one of the more interesting ones, though, is that, I mean, there's kind of a pyramid of there's kind of a hierarchy in college where a lot of times elite schools like a Harvard, for example, will set policies that end up filtering down through the whole system. You know, in the late 70s, Harvard came up with this model for how to finance a university that they called the high tuition, high aid model. The theory being that if you charge high tuition to the kids who, you know, the families who will do anything for their kid to go to a school like Harvard, you know, and they'll pay, you know, are wealthy and will pay top dollar to do that, then you can use some of the proceeds from higher tuition to give more discounts or more loans to middle class or underprivileged students. And, you know, at the Ivies, this model to a degree has worked, you know, that they do have kind of needs blind financial aid programs at a school like Harvard. You know, the problem is that other schools to compete in the system, because it became very competitive for students, especially after the baby boom ended. Schools found that they could compete for students not by offering low prices. They found they could compete by offering prestige. You had this arms race of prestige, you know, in terms of amenities like rock climbing walls or lazy rivers going through campus or food courts and, you know, high rise dorms with flat screen TVs. And, you know, this was part of the pressure. You know, state colleges found that really to keep all the plates spinning, that they could really market themselves to wealthier out of state kids, because out of state tuition is often two or three times higher than in state tuition, and or international students. You know, you saw rules relaxed so that more and more kids could come here from China and other overseas nations in the early 2000s. And if you go to many campuses today, you see the effects of that. And middle-class kids who want to go to school in their home states for a low price were the ones who really suffered from this system.
Yeah. And the for-profit model continues to accelerate. And then you begin these explicitly for-profit colleges, which there's an understanding that these are predatory institutions selling a dream to people, largely non-white Americans. And essentially, the return on investment, even if you're ceding that framing to on education to the right, which I don't like to do, but it's not a good one. And also, a lot of what they provided ended up being disadvantageous and predatory, as I mentioned. Talk about the proliferation of for-profit chains in the early 2000s, would you say, is when they start to gain some momentum and start cropping up?
Yeah, well, what happened is, you know, around the 70s or 80s, you started to see what experts call credentialism, which is this idea that more and more jobs require a college diploma. And I mean, interestingly, you know, we're now going back and realizing that maybe a lot of these jobs really didn't require a college diploma. But for whatever reason, recruiters hit on this as a way to do their job, you know, get the best candidates. And so, you know, and this filtered down to young people. They knew that, you know, if I want to have any hope of having a middle class lifestyle, which of course is what everybody hopes for, middle class or better, I've got to get a college degree. And capitalism abhors a vacuum like that. And into that vacuum poured this, you know, vulture class of these for-profit universities. There are variations. As I write in the introduction to my book, interestingly, my family actually, until it closed a couple of years ago, ran a small for-profit university, founded on kind of 20th century honest principles, you know, but at the end of the 20th century, these bigger companies like EMDC, which were financed by Goldman Sachs, entered the sector and with all the worst excesses of late stage capitalism, you know, boiler room operations to recruit kids, a pricing structure that was basically based on what's the maximum amount of federally guaranteed loans that these kids can get. And that's where we're going to set tuition. Cause what that means basically is the schools get the money up front guaranteed by the government, but it's the kids who are going to have the debt going forward. And in return for that, return for all that money they were making, again, you know, capitalism, right? It's what's the minimal education we can give these kids, you know, with, you know, overworked and, you know, maybe not the greatest adjunct professors in some cases, and also just over promises to these kids on, you know, that they're going to get help with job placement and they're going to have this fabulous career on the other side. And it just didn't happen. And it got even worse, you know, after 2008 with the Great Recession, because then there really was nothing for these kids coming out of these schools. And yet, you know, they had borrowed, you know, and sometimes the amounts they'd borrowed weren't large. You know, when we talk about these like $10,000 and $20,000 debts that hopefully got wiped out by President Biden last month, that's some of these kids, but some of these kids owe more, you know, $50,000 or $70,000, or when I say kids, a lot of them aren't necessarily kids. They might be people in their 30s or 40s also who might have gone back to school, but people, again, this desperation to have a diploma, you know. And I mean, that's the other half of my book, is just the social and political aspects of a society that's increasingly divided among people who have this piece of paper, the diploma, and the people who don't, and all the resentments and anger that's been generated about either not having it or what you had to go through to get it, or, you know, I mean, you saw a lot of it pour out, right, with the with Biden's announcement. If you spend any time on social media, the debates were heated because people have incredibly strong opinions about their loans or about the fact that they decided not to go to college because they felt they couldn't afford it. It's a very passionate subject for many people, and understandably so.
And I mean, when we talk about broader social programs on this show, we'll say universality is always the right way to go, because otherwise it breeds resentment. And in this case, it's incredibly acute. I want to move to that portion of your book in one second, but I had just one follow-up question about you mentioned the economic collapse of 2008, and what is and how that affected so many of these borrowers and people who were in debt going to who were going to college or who had graduated from college. And that is where the cancel student debt movement came out of. I mean, we had Astra Taylor on the show.
She's great. She's great. Yeah.
She's great. We've had her on a few times, but particularly after Biden made this decision. And I just asked her to reflect on the fact that it was seen as kind of pie in the sky at that time. And, oh, it's these Occupy hippies who are asking to cancel student debt. Bernie Sanders then incorporates it. Elizabeth Warren gets on board. Then Chuck Schumer, then Biden. And so that's, for the Democratic Party standards, that's a fairly quick turnaround for a policy that comes out of the left, which we don't typically see, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a great story. And I tell the story in my book because, you know, I mean, I felt for a long time, and I've written about this frequently, I covered Occupy Wall Street and the Occupy movement intensively when it took place in 2011. And I've kind of stayed on the story because, you know, it did flow right into Bernie Sanders' campaign. And in fact, I did a ebook for Amazon about the Bernie Sanders campaign. Well, about Occupy in 2011. Then I did another one about the Sanders campaign in 2015, 2016. When I covered the Sanders campaign and I went to so many rallies, the things that people told me that was such a motivator for them was college debt. You know, that this, you know, that somebody was finally talking about this. You know, and that this should have been an issue earlier. And, you know, the only issue that matters to me is how am I going to get out of my mom's basement? They really tapped into something. And, you know, I think, you know, when you look at the story of what Biden did last month, it is the story of, it's a great story about how activism and how it can work, that it's not hopeless. Because, I mean, you're talking about a small gaggle of people with a chalkboard in one corner of Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan, talking about this, to forming groups, to trying to raise awareness, to having a few small protests, to the fact where now it's being talked about by a presidential candidate, to where by 2020, now it's being talked about by the presidential nominee, to 2020, where now the guy is the president and he actually does something about it. And I mean, that's an amazing story. And, but you know, I mean, it shows the potency of this issue, but again, I think it also shows that, you know, what Biden did on debt was just really a first step, that, you know, that now that the issue has been acknowledged as an important issue, now what do we do to go the rest of the way and try and solve this?
And so that's a good part, I think, segue to talk about some of the resentment that you mentioned that it breeds, and some of the divisions that commercializing college to this degree has caused. One angle that was fascinating to me in the midst of the student debt conversation was how Republicans were just saying out loud how, well, this is going to hurt military recruitment, because to bring us back, I mean, this is that is really one of the few ways that, or one of the, I think, top reasons that young kids will join the military, because your college is paid for. And if you have broad liberatory policies of Jubilee and all those things and free college for all, that removes another just piece of leverage that the government or that power that our power structures have over people. And that's just one of the many layers of like class divisions. Now there's this even sharper divide between the college educated and the non-college educated. Talk a bit about how this has created these divisions in 2022.
Yeah, well, I think you really hit on it when you used a minute ago, when you used the word universality. I mean, I think that's such an important concept, because universality gets very tricky when you start talking about higher education, at least the way that we've constructed it in this country. Basically, when, to the extent that we had this debate about college and higher education being a public good back in the 50s and 60s, you know, kind of what was settled on was, well, we want to make opportunities to go to college more universal, but not actual, you know, not that everybody is guaranteed to go to college, but everybody has a shot at going to college, you know, that was universality. And the underlying principle of that system was, you know, for better or worse, what we've now come to call a meritocracy, right? That everybody's got the opportunity to go to college, but the ones who are going to make the most out of it are the people with merit, you know, the people who work the hardest, really put their, you know, shoulder to the grindstone or whatever the expression is, and get it done. And, you know, maybe they have obstacles, but they're the ones who can know how to overcome these obstacles. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting, because if you actually delve into the history of the concept of meritocracy, I mean, the term was first invented in the 50s as satire. Like, nobody believed that the people who invented the term didn't really think there actually was going to be a meritocracy, and they were right, basically. I mean, the two things I'd say about meritocracy is, number one, it's rigged, basically, right? I mean, you look at some of the structures that are actually in place, like, you know, wealthier families being able to give kids things like SAT preparation. I mean, the SATs are supposed to be, you know, this icon of the meritocracy, that you're a smart kid, you get a higher score and you get better opportunities. But people who get better scores are subsidized by wealthy families tutoring them for years, right? And how to do better on the test.
I would have not done very well on the SATs if I did not have the math tutor that I had. Seriously, like, my score, I think, raised by like 120 or 130. Wow. Because I'm bad at math, but I learned how to take the test. That was really, and that's what all of that is. It's not a measure of your intelligence. It's just how you understand how the test is structured. It's ridiculous.
And many families just didn't have that, don't get that opportunity do that. And just quickly, we all know about legacy admissions, right? This idea that if you went to Harvard, your chances of your kid going to Harvard are a lot better than, or some elite university. So that's the rigged aspect of the meritocracy. But the other thing is, you know, more broadly, when you proclaim that you have a meritocracy, the reality is that only 37% of American adults have a 4-year degree. It's funny, when you ask people who are college educated, they think the number is higher, but no, it's 37%, or conversely, 63% don't have a college degree, a 4-year degree. So, are we saying that 63% of the American public is somehow lacking in merit, because they don't have this piece of paper? And, you know, this whole credentialism, the more value that society places on this diploma, the more emotion it's going to trigger among people who didn't get it for whatever opportunity, because they couldn't afford it, or they didn't have the aptitude to go to college, or whatever. And, you know, it creates a system that arguably, you know, undervalues the type of work that people did that don't require a college education. It used to be different. You know, it's interesting. You know, some psychologists did a study. They looked at some data, and they were kind of maybe surprised to find that if you went back to 1970, which is, I think, kind of when things started to veer off a lot, if you go back to that time, measures of happiness weren't that different for people with a college education or without a college education. If you look at that today, there's a huge swing. One thing that I talk about in the book, and it's not something that people necessarily talk about when they talk about the college problems in America, but we should talk about it, is this issue among the non-college educated involving deaths of despair, as it's called. The fact that, you know, sociologists have found that, increasingly in America, if you don't have a college degree, you're more likely to die in your part of the working class, you're more likely to die by suicide or by drug overdose or alcohol. And, it is, again, this failure of this meritocracy idea. And, which is why in the book, you know, I talk about universality, that if you're going to solve the college problem, it's got to be a universal solution. You can't just absolve debts and give free college to the 37%. You have to be mindful of what does the 63% need, that they're not getting, that we can give them. And it's complicated, because, I mean, some of it is probably tangible in terms of, you know, we shouldn't just have free or inexpensive college, but we should have free or inexpensive trade school or apprenticeships or other types of things that, because there are many good jobs that, either now don't require a college degree, or if they do, maybe they shouldn't require a college degree. You know, some companies like IBM are actually going through their job kit lists and removing college degree requirements for jobs, because they realize what a problem these things have become. And, so part of the solution is that, and then part of it, I guess, is our attitude, right? You know, do we look down on people who didn't get a college degree? I feel like, you know, people are always comparing our situation to Europe, and not that Europe is perfect and doesn't have problems, but I do feel if you look at European countries, workers who don't go to college have a much better deal. They have better training in terms of apprenticeships and trade school. I think when they get those jobs, there's not the difference in respect that you have in America between college people and non-college people. And they also get, you know, they get a better deal. They get, you know, 6 weeks of vacation and healthcare and all of those things. And, you know, if you had those things, as you can imagine, obviously resentment would decrease. And, you know, and look, maybe some of the resentment that people in the working class feel and that they direct towards college people should instead be directed to the fact that they don't have healthcare or that they don't have 6 weeks of paid vacation. But that's not the way, humans are wired, right?
Yeah.
Humans are wired to resent somebody. And you've got the you know, Rush Limbaugh, the late Rush Limbaugh, or the Tucker Carlsons of the world, who know how to direct that resentment towards politically towards certain people. So,
And lastly, in terms of the divisions that I think you really, that you highlighted, one that stuck out to me was the geographical divisions. And if you don't mind touching on that, that would be excellent. And also kind of how it plays into the initial example that you give in your book about Kenyon College in Ohio. Just some of how this is, how these geographic and, as we, you know, talked about, socioeconomic divisions have been so widened and polarized, and I guess how that looks.
Well, a couple things about that. One is, yeah, so I started the book in Knox County, Ohio, which is home to Kenyon College. Not because it's typical of America nowadays, but because it's, in a way, it's so atypical because, you know, for the most part, we live deep in these silos of people, you know, who are like us and who think like us politically. Knox County, you have this weird situation where I compare Gambier, Ohio, which is the small hometown of Kenyon, to kind of like West Berlin during the Cold War, in that it's, you know, surrounded by enemy territory on all four sides, because, you know, you've got this county that voted 75% for Donald Trump. And in the middle of it is this college village that voted 89% for Joe Biden, which is just kind of crazy. And obviously it's mostly people not from Ohio. They're mostly people from, you know, Hollywood and the Upper West Side of New York. And, you know, 20% of the student body at Kenyon is from the top 1%, and more than, I think, 60% are from the top 20% of income in this country. And a very small number of the students there are working class folks who receive Pell Grants. So I wanted to look at what this line likes and what happens when these two worlds collide. And it was kind of interesting. But I think more broadly, the reality is, some listeners may be familiar with a book that came out about 20 years ago called The Big Sort. And, I think that title really kind of describes an important phenomenon that happened in this country, which is, we become culturally just attuned to wanting to live in communities of people who are like us. And and the politics is not the main driver. It's educated people want to live in communities that are diverse and have different experiences, you know, ethnic foods and hip bands and, Richard Florida writes about the creative class and how, you know, that they created these new cities and this phenomenon where, the jobs came to the cities instead of the cities coming to the jobs, basically, so you have these silos that attract educated people. And of course, we're seeing some of the downsides now in the insane rents that people pay to live in these places and other things. And then you have the Rust Belt, which, you know, if you're a smart, you know, ambitious kid from a Rust Belt town, you're going to go away to college and you're not going to come back, right? You're going to go to one of those cities, and the people increasingly are left behind. I mean, they have their churches and they have their, you know, VFW halls and clubs. It's kind of fascinating. You know, sociologists had always assumed that, that the most economically productive communities would also be the most socially cohesive ones. And they found now in the 21st century, it's just the opposite, that the more social cohesion you find in terms of people being together in organizations like churches, you know, the less economic activity you find. It's played out politically in this college, non-college divide. And, you know, we all know what a big factor non-college voters were in electing Donald Trump in 2016. And, you know, kind of meanwhile, the increasing flow of suburban people and college educated people to the Democratic Party is what brought Joe Biden back in 2020. So the culture and the politics have just become very intertwined, and college is really the ultimate driver of this, or not going to college.
Well, I can't recommend Will's book more highly, After the Ivory Tower Falls, How College Broke the American Dream and Blew Up Our Politics and How to Fix It. Will, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun to talk about it. Thanks.
Of course.
And we are back here on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and I am now joined for the fun half of the show, which we will be going into right now, by the Discourses, Brandon Sutton. Brandon, how you doing?
Great. It's lovely to be here, as always, Matt. It's lovely to be, you know, I just say it, just another boys' day with the team.
Yeah, it's the boys'
day. Got all the boys here.
Yeah, that's what I say. That's been clipped for the intro to the second half. That's correct. But Brandon, before we go into the second half, the fun half, what's happening over on the Discourse?
Well, like I said, I don't like to make any promises, but we should have an episode out for all of our few viewers this week. You know, fingers crossed. Wish us some good luck. There's a lot of moving going on amongst my co-hosts, so it's difficult to meet to get some time. So pray for us. Thoughts and prayers. No one needs them more than some podcasters right now, obviously.
Right, right. Everyone's first thought when in their prayers today will be that the Discourse gets their latest episode out.
Because, together.
Right. Nothing else. Nothing else is happening, which people should be praying for today. I mean, some of us are praying for something in that realm, but not exactly probably what people are praying happens. But
you don't need to pray. Whatever magic you believe in, you can send my way.
Right. There we go. Matt Leck, what's happening over on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, tonight we're doing one of our twice a month crossover streams with This Is Revolution. It'll be on the Left Reckoning YouTube and the This Is Revolution one, and we're doing a think tank for patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, to become a patron of our show.
There we go. Crossing of the streams. Great. Yeah. Mm. And
well, you know, I'm not the host, but I'll ask you, Matt, so you don't have to ask yourself, what's going on Doomed in the scam economy?
Oh, thank you. Oh, that worked out really nice. Otherwise, it would have sounded like I was like, hey, and here's my show. On Doomed, I had a regular listener of the show, a friend of the show, on as a guest, Rene Moncoyo. He is our Chilean correspondent, and he basically gave us a breakdown of what happened in Chile over this past weekend, which saw the people of Chile basically voting against this new progressive constitution that was supposed to replace the longstanding constitution of that country from the days of Pinochet. So, we talked about what happened, how this went down. And then tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time on Scam Economy, I will be talking to Jacob Silverman, who is he's a journalist who's writing a book with actor Ben McKenzie on crypto. But we talk about a mystery going on. It's really a long-standing mystery, but he asked Binance on Twitter in like a throwaway question, trying to solve a long-standing mystery in terms of why is this random, supposedly low-level employee listed as on pretty much like almost all of Binance's paperwork as like a major figure, like perhaps even an owner of the company. And it's been a question that hasn't gotten an answer for a long time. And Binance, the world's largest crypto exchange, saw his question and sort of had a little bit of a meltdown and wrote like an essay about the whole thing. So we talk about all that happened with that. Very entertaining episode. So for Doomed, doomedcast.com. For Scam Economy, scameconomy.com. That's where you could find the podcast version of those shows. And both are available as video at youtube.com/Matt Binder. And you can watch live tonight, Scam Economy, 9 p.m. Eastern time, youtube.com/Matt Binder. And Bradley, what's going on with ESVN? What'd you guys do on Tuesday on the debut episode?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. The inaugural episode of ESVN. We basically did a very inadvertently long preview of the NFL season. We went through every division. We did some playoff picks, some Super Bowl picks. Did some betting recommendations, light betting recommendations. Mine require no money. My only betting priority is to beat Emma for next week. And we did a few, we talked a little bit about some fantasy football recommendations as well, and also about the legacy of Serena Williams. So that's up on the MR YouTube page as well as the Majority Report website. And we are still just working on kind of getting our, all of our ducks in a row for all of the other audio platforms to get that in out. But so you can go find that on our YouTube page as well as the Majority Report website.
I got to say, this is the first time I've been on the show since it debuted. I want to say love the name. Really, really fantastic name.
Thank you. We figured it's key. Keep it simple, stupid.
Right. Although you got to fit your name in there somehow, right?
No.
ESPN featuring Brett.
Yeah. too many letters.
Right. All right, folks, that is the show for today. Join us in the fun half where we will be talking about, I mean, geez, I'm looking at this list of sound clips for sound, and we got
everything, basically.
Yeah, we got quite the show. And on top of that, ongoing coverage of the topic number one in all Majority Report listeners' minds, and also something we cover regularly on this show, obviously. What's going on with the Queen and the royal family? Mm. Obviously, we'll be covering that. All right, see you all in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts! Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go throw up.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. Call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sundial guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.